room. When they were alone, Lady Sarah asked her uncle, "Will that suffice?" Sir James Almont chuckled. "In spades, my dear," he said. "In spades." He laughed aloud. "We will see blood in Port Royal before dawn. Mark my words." "I am eager to help, my lady," Richard said. The loyal servant had been smarting for weeks under the injustice that had placed his master under armed guard. "Who can enter Marshalsea?" Mrs. Hacklett asked. She had seen the building from the outside, but had not, of course, ever entered it. Indeed, it was impossible that she ever do so. In the face of criminality, a high-born woman sniffed and looked away. "Can you enter the prison?"
"Nay, madam," Richard said. "Your husband has posted his special guard. They'd cite me at once and bar my way."
"Then who can?"
"A woman," Richard said.
Food and necessary personal articles were brought to prisoners by friends and relatives. It was ordinary custom. "What woman? She must be clever and avoid search."
"There's only one I can think," Richard said. "Mistress Sharp."
Mrs. Hacklett nodded. She remembered Mistress Sharp, one of the 37 convict women who made the crossing on the Godspeed. Since then, Mistress Sharp had become the most popular courtesan in the port. "See to it," Miss Hacklett said, "with no delay."
"And what shall I promise her?"
"Say that Captain Hunter will reward her generously and justly, as I am sure he shall."
Richard nodded, then hesitated.
"Madam," he said,
"I trust you are aware of the consequence of freeing Captain Hunter."
With a coldness that gave Richard a shudder down his spine, the woman answered, "I am not only aware, I devoutly seek it."
"Very good, madam," Richard said, and slipped off into the night.
In the darkness, the turtles penned in Chocolata Hole surfaced and snapped their sharp beaks. Standing nearby, Mistress Sharp, flouncing and laughing, giggled and twisted away from one of the guards, who fondled her breast. She blew him a kiss and continued on to the shadow of the high wall of Marshalsea. She carried a crock of turtle stew in her arms. Another guard accompanied her to Hunter's cell. This one was surly and half-drunk. He paused with the key in the lock.
"Why do you hesitate?" she asked.
"What lock was ever opened without a lusty turning?" he asked, leering.
"The lock is better for proper oiling," she leered back.
"Aye, lady, and for a proper key as well."
"I judge you to have the key," she said. "But for the lock, well, that must wait the proper time. Leave me a few minutes with this hungry dog, and then we shall have ourselves a turning such as you will not forget."
The guard chuckled and unlocked the door. She went in. The door was locked behind her, and the guard remained.
"A few minutes with this man," she said, "as decency permits."
"'Tis not allowed."
"Who cares for that?" she said, and licked her lips hungrily at the guard.
He smiled back at her and walked away.
As soon as he was gone, she set down the pot of stew on the floor and faced Hunter.
Hunter did not recognize her, but he was hungry, and the smell of the turtle stew was strong and agreeable.
"You are most kind," he said.
"You hardly know," she replied, and in a quick gesture, lifted her skirts from the hem, pulling up to her waist.
It was an astonishingly lewd movement, but more astounding for what was revealed. Strapped to her calves and thighs was a veritable armory, 2 knives, 2 pistols.
"My secret parts are said to be dangerous," she said, "and now you know the truth."
Quickly, Hunter took the weapons and stashed them in his belt.
"Do not, sir, discharge prematurely."
"You may count upon my staying power."
"How long may I count?"
"To 100, Hunter said, "and there's a promise."
She looked back in the direction of the guard.
"I shall hold you to your word at another time," she said. "In the meanwhile, shall I be raped?"
"I think it best," Hunter said, and flung her to the ground.
She squealed and screamed, and the guard came running.
He saw the import of the scene in a moment, and hastily unlocked the door, running into the room.
"You damnable pirate!" he growled, and then the knife in Hunter's fist was buried in his neck, and he staggered back, clutching at the blade beneath his chin. He pulled it free and blood gushed out, a hissing fountain, and then he collapsed and died.
"Quickly, lady," Hunter said, helping Anne Sharp to her feet. All around them, the men jailed in Marshalsea were silent. They had heard, and they were utterly quiet. Hunter went around, opening cell doors. Then he gave the keys to the men and let them finish the task.
"How many guards at the gates?" he asked Anne Sharp.
"I saw 4, she said, "and another dozen on the ramparts."
This presented a problem for Hunter. The guards were English, and he had no stomach for killing them.
"We must have a ruse," he said. "Call the captain to you."
She nodded and stepped out into the courtyard. Hunter remained behind in the shadows. Hunter did not marvel at the composure of this woman, who had just watched a man brutally slain. He was not accustomed to the faint-heartedness of women, so fashionable in the French and Spanish courts. English women were tough-minded, in some ways tougher than any male, and it was equally true of low- and high-born women. The captain of the Marshalsea Guard came over to Anne Sharp, and at the last moment saw the barrel of Hunter's pistol protruding from the shadows. Hunter beckoned him over.
"Now hear me," Hunter said. "You may call your men down and have them throw their muskets to the ground, and no lives shall be lost. Or you can stand and fight, and all surely die."
The captain of the guard said,
"I've been awaiting your escape, sir, and I hope you will remember me in the days to come."
"We shall see," Hunter said, promising nothing.
In a formal voice, the captain said, "Commander Scott shall have his own action upon the morrow."
"Commander Scott," Hunter said, "shall not live to see the morrow. Now take your stand."
"I hope you will remember me."
"I may," Hunter said. "Remember not to slit your throat."
The captain of the guard called his men down, and Hunter supervised their locking up in the Marshalsea jail. Mrs. Hacklett, having given her instructions to Richards, returned to her husband's side. He was in the library, drinking after dinner with Commander Scott. Both men had in recent days become enamored of the governor's wine cellar and were engaged in consuming it before the governor recovered. They were, at this moment, deep in their cups.
"My dear," her husband said as she entered the room, "you come at a most opportune moment."
"Indeed?"
"Indeed," Robert Hacklett said. "Why, just this very moment I was explaining to Commander Scott the manner of your getting with child by the pirate Hunter. You understand, of course, that he will soon swing in the breeze until the flesh rots off his bones. In this beastly climate, I am told, that happens quickly. But I am sure you know of haste, eh?"
"Why, speaking of your seduction, Commander Scott was not previously acquainted with the details of the event.
I have been informing him."
Mrs. Hacklett flushed deeply.
"So demure," Hacklett said, his voice taking a nasty edge. "One would never think her a common bawd, and yet that is what she is. What would her favors fetch, do you think?"
Commander Scott sniffed at a perfumed handkerchief.
"Shall I be frank?" "By all means, be frank. Be frank.
She is too lean for the usual taste."
"Her Majesty liked her well enough."
"Perhaps, perhaps. But that is not the usual taste, eh?
Our king has a preference for hot-blooded foreign women." "So be it," Hacklett said irritably. "What would she fetch?"
"I should think she would fetch not above, well, considering she has tasted the royal lancet, perhaps more, but in no case above 100 reales.
Mrs. Hacklett, very red, turned to leave.
"I shall attend no more of this."
"On the contrary," her husband said, leaping from his chair and barring her way, "you shall attend a good deal more. Commander Scott, you are a gentleman of worldly experience. Would you pay 100 reales?
Scott gulped his drink and coughed.
Not I, sir, he said.
Hacklett gripped his wife's arm. What price would you make?
50 reales.
Done, Hacklett said.
Robert, his wife protested. Good gracious God, Robert!
Robert Hacklett struck his wife in the face, a blow sending her across the room. She collapsed into a chair.
Now then, Commander, Hacklett said, you are a man of your word. I shall accept your credit in this matter.
Scott looked over the brim of his cup.
Eh? I said, I shall accept your credit in this matter. Have your money's worth.
Eh? You mean...
He gestured in the direction of Mrs. Hacklett, whose eyes were now wide with horror.
Indeed I do, and quickly, too.
Here? Now?
Precisely, Commander.
Hacklett, very drunk, staggered across the room and clapped his hand on the soldier's shoulder.
And I shall observe, for my own amusement.
No!
Shrieked Mrs. Hacklett. Her voice was piercingly loud, but neither man appeared to have heard her. They stared drunkenly at each other.
Faith, Scott said. I'm not sure 'tis wise. Nonsense, Hacklett said. You are a gentleman of reputation, and you must uphold that reputation. After all, this is a consort worthy of a king. Well, at least once worthy of a king. Go to it, man.
Damn me, Commander Scott said, getting unsteadily to his feet.
Damn me, I shall do, sir. What's good enough for a king is good enough for me. I shall do.
And he began to unbuckle his breeches. Commander Scott was exceedingly drunk, and his buckles proved difficult. Mrs. Hacklett began to scream, and her husband crossed the library and struck her in the face, cutting her lip. A trickle of blood ran down her chin.
A pirate's whore or a king's can have no heirs. Commander Scott, take your pleasure.
And Scott advanced upon the woman.
Move me, whispered Governor Almont to his niece.
But, Uncle, how?
Kill the god, he said, and handed her a pistol. Lady Sarah Almont took the pistol in her hands, feeling the unfamiliar shape of the weapon.
You cock it thus, said Almont, showing her. Now careful. Go to the door, ask to go out, and fire.
Fire how?
Directly into his face. Make no mistake here, my dear.
But, Uncle...
He glared at her.
I am a sick man, he said. Now help me.
She stepped a few paces toward the door.
Right down his throat, Almont said with a certain satisfaction. He's earned it, the traitorous dog.
She knocked on the door. What is it, miss? Said the guard.
Open up, she said. I wish to leave.
There was a scraping and a metallic click as the lock was turned. The door opened. She had a glimpse of the guard, a young man of 19. Fresh-faced and innocent, his expression bemused.
Whatever your ladyship desires.
She fired at his lips. The explosion rocked her arm and blew him backward, as if he had been struck full in the face. He twisted and slid to the ground, then rolled onto his back. She saw, with horror, that he had no face left, just a bloody pulp mounted on his shoulders. The body writhed on the ground for a few moments. Urine leaked down the leg of his trousers, and she smelled defecation. Then the body was still.
Help me move, croaked her uncle, the governor of Jamaica,
sitting up painfully in his bed. Hunter assembled his men at the north end of Port Royal, near the mainland. His immediate problem was wholly political. To reverse a judgment against him. As a practical matter, once he escaped, the townspeople would rally around him, and he would not again be jailed. But equally practical was the question of his response to unjust treatment, for Hunter's reputation within the town was at stake. He reviewed the 8 names in his mind. Hacklett, Scott, Lewisham, the judge of the Admiralty, Foster and Poorman, the merchants, Lieutenant Dodson, James Phipps, merchant captain, and last but not least, Sanson. Each of these men had acted with the full knowledge of the injustice. Each stood to profit from the confiscation. The laws of the privateers were solid enough. Such chicanery inevitably meant death and confiscation of the share. But at the same time, he would be obliged to kill several highly placed members of the town. That would be easy enough, but he might have a bad time of it later, if Sir James did not survive unscathed. If Sir James were worth his salt, he would have long since escaped to safety. Hunter would have to trust to that, he decided. And in the meantime, he would have to kill those who had crossed him. Shortly before dawn, he ordered all his men into the Blue Hills north of Jamaica, telling them to remain there for 2 days. Then, alone, he returned to the town.
Chapter 36. Foster, a prosperous silk merchant, owned a large house on Pembroke Street, northeast of the dockyards. Hunter slipped in through the back, passing the separate kitchen block. He made his way upstairs to the master bedroom on the second floor. He found Foster asleep in bed with his wife. Hunter awoke him by pressing a pistol lightly against his nostrils. Foster, a fattish man of 50, snorted and sniffed and rolled away. Hunter jammed the pistol barrel up one nostril. Foster blinked and opened his eyes. He sat up in bed, not saying a word.
"Be still," his wife muttered sleepily. "You toss so."
Yet she did not wake up. Hunter and Foster stared at each other. Foster looked from the pistol to Hunter and back again. Finally, Foster raised a finger in the air and gently eased out of bed. His wife still slept. In his nightgown, Foster padded across the room to a chest.
"I shall pay you well," he whispered. "See here, look."
He opened a false compartment and withdrew a sack of gold, very heavy.
"There is more, Hunter. I shall pay you whatever you want."
Hunter said nothing. Foster, in his nightshirt, extended his arm with the sack of gold. His arm trembled.
"Please," he whispered. "Please, please."
He got down on his knees.
"Please, Hunter, I pray you, please."
Hunter shot him in the face. The body was knocked back, the legs thrown up in the air, the bare feet kicking space. In the bed nearby, the wife never awoke, but turned sleepily and groaned. Hunter picked up the sack of gold and left as silently as he had come. Poorman, belying his name, was a rich trader in silver and pewter. His house was on High Street. Hunter found him asleep at a table in the kitchen, a half-empty bottle of wine before him. Hunter took a kitchen knife and slashed both Poorman's wrists. Poorman awoke groggily, saw Hunter, and then saw the blood pouring over the table. He raised his bleeding hands but could not move them. The tendons had all been cut, and the hands flopped lifelessly, rag-doll fingers already turning grayish-white. He let his arms drop again to the table. He watched the blood pool on the wood and drip through the cracks to the floor. He looked back at Hunter. His face was curious, his expression confused.
"I would have paid," he said hoarsely. "I would have done what you...
He stood up from the table, weaving dizzily, holding his injured arms bent at the elbows. In the silence of the room, the blood spattered with an odd loudness on the ground.
"I would have,"
Poorman began, and then rocked back and fell flat on the floor.
"Ye,
he said, fainter and fainter. Hunter turned away, not waiting for the man to die. He went back into the night air and slipped silently through the dark streets of Port Royal. He encountered Lieutenant Dodson by accident. The soldier was singing a song, stumbling drunk through the streets with two whores at his side. Hunter saw him at the end of the high street and turned back, slipping down Queen Street, turning east on Howell Alley, just in time to meet Dodson at the corner.
"Who goes there?" Dodson demanded, speaking loudly. "Know you that there is a curfew? Begone, else I shall clap you in the Marshalsea."
In shadow, Hunter said, "I have just come from there."
"Eh?" Dodson said, tilting his head toward the voice. "What means your churlish speech? I shall have you know."
"Hunter!"
shrieked the whores, and they both fled. Deprived of their support, Dodson fell drunkenly down into the mud.
"Damn you for uncertain quim," he grunted, and struggled to get up. "Look at my uniform now. Damn you all."
He was covered in mud and manure. He had already gotten to his knees when the words of the women suddenly reached his alcohol-fogged brain.
"Hunter?" he asked softly. "You are Hunter?"
Hunter nodded in the shadows.
"Then I shall arrest you for the scoundrel and pirate that you are," Dodson said.
But before he could get back to his feet, Hunter kicked him in the stomach and sent him sprawling.
"Ow!" Dodson said. "You hurt me, damn you!"
They were the last words he spoke. Hunter gripped the soldier by the neck and pressed his face into the mud and dung of the street, holding the squirming body, which struggled with increasing force and finally, toward the end, with violent wrenchings and twistings, until at last it did not move. Hunter stepped back, gasping for breath with the exertion. He looked around the dark, deserted town. A marching patrol of 10 militiamen went by. He stepped back into the shadows until they had passed. Two whores came by.
"Are you Hunter?"
one asked, with no sign of fear. He nodded.
"Bless you," she said. "You come see me, and you'll have your way without a farthing spent."
She laughed. Giggling, the two women disappeared into the night. He stood inside the Black Boar Tavern. There were 50 people there, but he saw only James Phipps, dapper and handsome, drinking with several other merchantmen. Phipps's companions immediately slipped away, showing aspects of terror on their faces. But Phipps himself, after an initial shock, took on a hearty manner.
"Hunter!" he said, grinning broadly. "Damn my eyes, but you have done what we all knew you would. A round for everyone, I say, to celebrate your new freedom."
There was utter silence in the Black Boar. No one spoke. No one moved.
"Come now," Phipps said loudly. "I call for a round in honor of Captain Hunter. A round!"
Hunter moved forward toward Phipps's table. His soft footsteps on the dirt floor of the tavern were the only sound in the room. Phipps eyed Hunter uneasily.
"Charles," he said, "Charles, this stern countenance does not become you. It is time to be merry."
"Is it?"
"Charles, my friend," Phipps said, "you surely understand I bear you no ill will. I was forced to appear on the tribunal. It was all the work of Hacklett and Scott, I swear it. I had no choice. I've a ship to sail in a week's time, Charles, and they would not give me embarkation papers, so they said. And I knew you would make good your escape. Only an hour ago I was telling Timothy Flint that very expectation. Timothy, answer true. Was I not telling you that Hunter would be free? Timothy?"
Hunter took out his pistol and aimed it at Phipps.
"Now, Charles," Phipps said, "I beg you to be reasonable. A man must be practical. Do you think I would have condemned you if ever I believed sentence would be carried out? Do you think so? Do you?"
Hunter said nothing. He cocked the pistol, a single metallic click in the silence of the room.
"Charles," Phipps said, "it does my heart good to see you again. Come, have a drink with me, and let us forget—"
Hunter shot him, full in the chest. Everyone ducked away as fragments of bone and a geyser of blood blew outward from his heart in a hissing rush. Phipps dropped a cup that had been raised in one hand. The cup struck the table and rolled to the floor. Phipps's eyes followed it. He reached for it with his hand and said hoarsely,
Drink, Charles.
And then he collapsed on the table. Blood seeped over the rude wood. Hunter turned and left. As he came out on the street again, he heard the tolling of the church bells of St. Anne's. They rang incessantly, the signal for an attack on Port Royal or some other emergency. Hunter knew it could have only one meaning. His escape from the jail of Marshalsea had been discovered. He did not mind at all. Lewisham, judge of the Admiralty, had his quarters behind the courthouse. He awoke to the church bells in alarm and sent a servant out to see what was the matter. The man returned a few minutes after.
"What is it?" Lewisham said. "Speak, man!"
The man looked up. It was Hunter.
"How is it possible?" Lewisham asked.
Hunter cocked the gun. "Easily," he said.
"Tell me what you wish."
"I shall," Hunter said. And he told him. Commander Scott, drowsy with drink, lay sprawled on a couch in the library of the governor's mansion. Mr. Hacklett and his mistress had long since retired. He awoke to the church bells and instantly knew what had happened. He felt a terror unlike any he had ever known. Moments later, one of his guard burst into the room with the news. Hunter had escaped. All the pirates were vanished, and Poorman, Foster, Phipps, and Dodson were all dead.
"Get my horse," Scott commanded, and hastily arranged his disarrayed clothing.
He emerged at the front of the governor's mansion, looked around cautiously, and jumped on his stallion. He was unhorsed a few moments later and flung rudely to the cobblestones no more than 100 yards from the governor's mansion. A contingent of vagabonds led by Richards, the governor's manservant, and directed by Hunter, that scoundrel, clapped him in irons and took him away to Marshalsea. To await trial. The nerve of the ruffians. Hacklett awoke to the tolling of the church bells and also guessed their meaning. He leapt out of bed, ignoring his wife, who had lain the whole night, wide awake, staring at the ceiling, listening to his drunken snores. She was in pain, and she had been badly humiliated. Hacklett went to the chamber door and called to Richards.
"What has transpired?"
"Hunter escaped," Richards said flatly. "Dodson and Poorman and Phipps are all dead, perhaps more."
"And the man is still loose?"
"I do not know," Richards said, pointedly failing to add, "Your Excellency."
"Dear God," Hacklett said.
"Bolt the doors. Call the guard. Alert Commander Scott."
"Commander Scott left some few minutes past."
"Left? Dear God," Hacklett said,
and slammed the chamber door, locking it. He turned back to the bed.
"Dear God," he said. "Dear God, we shall all be murdered by that pirate."
"Not all," his wife said, pointing a pistol at him. Her husband kept a brace of loaded pistols by the bed, and she now held them aimed at him, one in each hand.
"Emily," Hacklett said, "don't be a fool. This is no time for your silliness. The man is a vicious killer."
"Come no closer," she said.
He hesitated. "You jest."
"I do not." Hacklett looked at his wife and the pistol she held. He was not himself skilled with weapons, but he knew from limited experience that a pistol was extremely difficult to fire with accuracy. He did not feel fear so much as irritation.
"Emily, you are being a damnable fool."
"Stay," she commanded.
"Emily, you are a bitch and a whore, but you are not, I'll wager, a murderer, and I will have..."
She fired one gun. The room filled with smoke. Hacklett cried aloud in terror, and several moments passed before both husband and wife realized that he had not been hit. Hacklett laughed, mostly in relief.
"As you see," he said, "it is no simple matter. Now give me the pistol, Emily."
He came quite close before she fired again, hitting him in the groin. The impact was not powerful. Hacklett remained standing. He took another step, coming so near her that he could almost touch her.
"I have always hated you," he said in a conversational tone, "from the first day that I met you. Do you remember? I said to you, 'Good day, madam,' and you said to me..." He broke off into a coughing fit and collapsed on the ground, doubled over in pain. Blood was now seeping from his waist. "You said to me," he said, "you said, 'Oh, damn your black eyes, woman. It hurts.' You said to me..." He rocked on the ground, his hands pressed to his groin, his face twisted in pain, eyes shut tightly. He moaned in time to his rocking. She sat up in the bed and dropped the pistol. It touched the sheet, so hot that it burned the imprint of the barrel into the fabric. She quickly picked it up and flung it on the floor, then looked back at her husband. He continued to rock as before, still moaning, and then he stopped and looked over at her and spoke through clenched teeth.
"Finish it," he whispered.
She shook her head. The chambers were empty. She did not know how to load them again, even if there were spare shot and powder.
"Finish it," he said again.
A dozen conflicting emotions pressed in her mind. Realizing that he was not soon to die, she went to the side table and poured a glass of claret and brought it to him. She lifted his head and helped him to drink. He drank a little, and then a fury overcame him, and with one bloody hand he pushed her away. His strength was surprising. She fell back, with a red imprint of a flat hand on her nightdress.
"Damn you for a king's bitch," he whispered, and took up his rocking again.
He was now absorbed in his pain, and seemed to have lost any sense that she was there. She got to her feet, poured a glass of wine for herself, sipped it, and watched. She was still standing there when Hunter entered the room half an hour later. Hacklett was alive, but wholly ashen, his actions feeble except for an occasional spastic twitch. He lay in an enormous pool of blood. Hunter took out his pistol and moved toward Hacklett.
"No," she said.
He hesitated, then stepped away.
"Thank you for your kindness," Mrs. Hacklett said.
Chapter 37. On October 21st, 1665, the conviction of Charles Hunter and his crew on a charge of piracy and robbery was summarily overturned by Lewisham, Judge of the Admiralty, meeting in closed session with Sir James Almont, newly restored governor of the Jamaica colony. In the same session, Commander Edwin Scott, chief officer of the garrison of Fort Charles, was convicted of high treason and sentenced to be hanged the following day. A confession in his own handwriting was obtained on the promise of commutation of sentence. Once the letter was written, an unknown officer shot Scott to death in his cell in Fort Charles. The officer was never apprehended. For Captain Hunter, now the toast of the town, one final problem remained: André Sasson. The Frenchman was nowhere to be found, and it was reported that he had fled into the inland hills. Hunter put out the word that he would pay well for any news of Sasson, and by mid-afternoon he had a surprising report. Hunter had stationed himself publicly in the Black Boar, and soon enough an old bawdy woman came to see him. Hunter knew her. She ran a whoring house. Her name was Simmons. She approached him nervously. "Speak up, woman," he said, and he called for a glass of kill devil to ease her fears.
"Well, sir," she said, drinking the liquor, "a week past, a man of the name of Carter comes to Port Royal, desperate ill."
"Is this John Carter, a seaman?"
"The same."
"Speak on," Hunter said.
"He says he has been picked up by an English packet boat from St. Kitts. They had spotted a fire on a small uninhabited quay, and pausing to investigate, had found this Carter marooned, and brought him thence."
"Where is he now?"
"Oh, he has fled, he has. He's terrified of meeting with Sasson, the Frenchy villain. He's in the hills now, but he told me his story right enough.
Hunter said. And that is? The body woman told the story quickly. Carter was aboard the sloop Cassandra, carrying part of the galleon treasure under Saint-Saëns' command. There had been a fierce hurricane, in which the ship was wrecked on the inner reef of an island, and most of the crew killed. Saint-Saëns had gathered the others together and had salvaged the treasure, which he directed them to bury on the island. Then they had all built a longboat with the flotsam of the wrecked sloop. And then, Carter had reported, Saint-Saëns had killed them all, 12 men, and set sail alone. Carter had been badly wounded, but somehow survived and lived to return home and tell his story. And he said further that he did not know the name of the island nor the exact location of the treasure, but that Saint-Saëns had scratched a map on a coin, which he then hung around his neck. Hunter listened to the story in silence, thanked the woman, and gave her a coin for her trouble. More than ever now, he wanted to find Saint-Saëns. He sat in the Black Boar and patiently listened to every person with a rumor of the Frenchman's whereabouts. There were at least a dozen stories. Saint-Saëns had gone to Port Morant. Saint-Saëns had fled to Inagua. Saint-Saëns had gone into hiding in the hills. When finally the truth came, it was stunning. Enders burst into the tavern. "Captain, he's on board the galleon." "What?" "Aye, sir. There were 6 of us set as guard. He killed 2 and sent the rest in the boat to tell you." "Tell me what?" "Either you arrange his pardon and discard openly your feud with him, or he'll sink the ship, Captain. Sink her at anchor. He must have your word by nightfall, Captain." Hunter swore. He went to the window of the tavern and looked out at the harbor. El Trinidad rode lightly at anchor, but she was moored well offshore in deep water, too deep to salvage any treasure if she were sunk. "He's damnably clever," Enders said. "Indeed," Hunter said. "Will you make your reply?" "Not now," Hunter said. He turned away from the window. "Is he alone on the ship?" "Aye, if that matters." Saint-Saëns alone was worth a dozen men or more in an open battle. The treasure galleon was not moored close to any other ships in the harbor. Nearly a quarter mile of open water surrounded it on all sides. It stood in splendid, impregnable isolation. "I must think," Hunter said, and went to sit again. A ship moored in open, placid water was as safe as a fortress surrounded by a moat. And what Saint-Saëns did next made him even safer. He dumped slops and garbage all around the vessel to attract sharks. There were plenty of sharks in the harbor anyway, so that swimming to El Trinidad was a form of suicide. Nor could any boat approach the ship without being easily spotted. Therefore, the approach must be open and apparently harmless. But an open longboat gave no opportunity for hiding. Hunter scratched his head. He paced the floor of the Black Boar and then, still restless, he went out into the street. There he saw a water spouter, a common conjurer of the day, sprouting streams of multicolored water from his lips. Conjuring was forbidden in the Massachusetts colony as tending to promote the work of the devil. For Hunter, it had an odd fascination. He watched the water spouter for several moments as he drank and spewed different kinds of water one after another. Finally, he went up to the man. "I want to know your secrets." "Many a fine woman in the court of King Charles has said as much and offered more than you have offered." "I offer you," Hunter said, "your life." And he pressed a loaded pistol in his face. "You'll not bully me," the conjurer said. "I fancy I will." And a few moments later, he was back in the conjurer's tent, hearing the details of his exploits. "Things are not as they seem," said the conjurer. "Show me," Hunter said. The conjurer explained that before a performance, he swallowed a pill confected of the gall of a heifer and baked wheat flour. "This cleanses my stomach, you see." "I do. Go on." "Next, I take a mixture of Brazil nuts and water, boiled until it is dark red in color. I swallow this before I work." "Go on." "Then I wash the glasses with white vinegar." "Go on." "And some glasses not so washed." "Go on." Then the water spouter explained. He drank water from clean glasses and regurgitated the contents of his stomach, producing glasses of bright red claret. In other glasses, which had a coating of vinegar, the same liquid became beer of a dark brown color. Drinking and regurgitating more water produced a lighter red color, which was called sherry.
"There's no more trick to it than that," said the conjurer. "Things are not as they seem, and that's an end to it," he sighed. "It's all in directing attention to the wrong place."
Hunter thanked the man and went off to search for Enders.
"Do you know the woman who enabled our release from Marshalsea?"
"Ann Sharp is her name."
"Find her," Hunter said, "and get for the longboat crew 6 of the best men you can muster."
"Why, Captain?"
"We are going to pay a visit to Saint-Saëns."
Chapter 38. André Saint-Saëns, the lethal, powerful Frenchman, was not accustomed to the sensation of fear, and he did not feel afraid as he saw the longboat put out from shore. He observed the boat carefully. From a distance, he could see 6 oarsmen and 2 people sitting in the bow, but he could not discern who they were. He expected some ruse. The Englishman Hunter was crafty, and he would use his craft if he could. Saint-Saëns knew that he was not clever, as Hunter was. His own talents were more animal, more directly physical. And yet he was confident that there was no trick Hunter could play upon him. It was, very simply, impossible. He was alone on this ship, and he would remain alone, safely, until night fell. But he would have his freedom by dusk, or he would destroy the ship. And he knew Hunter would never let the ship be destroyed. He had fought too hard and suffered too much for that treasure. He would do anything to keep it, even to the point of releasing Saint-Saëns. The Frenchman was confident. He peered at the approaching longboat. As it came nearer, he saw that Hunter himself stood in the prow, along with some woman. What could be the meaning of this? His head ached to wonder what Hunter had planned. Yet in the end, he contented himself with the reassurance that no trick was possible. Hunter was clever, but there was a limit to cleverness. And Hunter must know that even from a distance he could be picked off as quickly and simply as a man brushes a fly from his sleeve. Saint-Saëns could kill him now if he wished, but there was no reason. All he wanted was his freedom and a pardon. For that, he needed Hunter alive. The longboat came closer, and Hunter waved cheerfully.
"Saint-Saëns, you French pig!" he called.
Saint-Saëns waved back, grinning.
"Hunter, you English pox of a sheep!"
He shouted with a joviality that he did not feel at all. His tension was considerable, and increased as he realized how casually Hunter was behaving. The longboat pulled alongside El Trinidad. Saint-Saëns leaned over slightly, showing them the crossbow. But he did not want to lean too far, though he was eager for a look inside the boat.
"Why are you here, Hunter?"
"I have brought you a present. May we come aboard?"
"You two only,"
Saint-Saëns said, and stepped back from the railing. He quickly ran to the opposite side of the ship to see if another longboat was approaching from another direction. He saw nothing but calm water and the rippling fins of cruising sharks. Turning back, he heard the sound of 2 people clambering up the side of the ship. He aimed his crossbow as a woman appeared. She was young and damnably pretty. She smiled at him, almost shyly, and stepped to one side as Hunter came on deck. Hunter paused and looked at Saint-Saëns, who was 20 paces away, with the crossbow in his hands.
"Not a very hospitable greeting," Hunter said.
"You must forgive me," Saint-Saëns said.
He looked at the girl, then back to Hunter.
"Have you arranged to meet my demands?"
"I am doing so, even as we talk.
Sir James is drawing up the papers, and they shall be delivered in a few hours."
"And the meaning of this visit?"
Hunter gave a short laugh. "Saint-Saëns," he said, "you know me for a practical man. You know that you have all the cards. I must agree to anything you say. This time you have been too clever, even for me.
I know, Sanson said. Someday, Hunter said, his eyes narrowing, I shall find you and kill you. I promise you that. But for now, you have won.
This is a trick,
Sanson said, with a sudden realization that something was very wrong. No trick, Hunter said. Torture.
Torture?
Indeed, Hunter said. Things are not always as they seem. So that you may spend the afternoon in pleasurable pursuits, I have brought you this woman. Surely we can agree that she is most charming, for an Englishwoman. I will leave her here for you, Hunter laughed. If you dare. Now Sanson laughed.
Hunter, you are the devil's own servant. I cannot take this woman without ceasing to keep watch, yes?
May her English beauty torment you, Hunter said. And then, with a short bow, he climbed over the side. Sanson listened to the thud of his feet on the hull of the ship, and then a final thump as Hunter landed in the longboat. He heard Hunter order the boat to put off, and he heard the stroke of the oars. It was a trick, he thought. Somehow, a trick. He looked at the woman. She must be armed in some fashion.
Lie down, he growled harshly.
She seemed confused.
Lie down,
he said, and stamped the deck. She lay on the deck, and he moved cautiously over to her, then frisked her through her garments. She had no weapons, yet he was sure it was a trick. He went to the railing and looked out at the longboat, now pulling strongly for shore. Hunter sat in the bow, facing land, not looking back. There were six oarsmen. Everyone was accounted for.
May I get up? The girl asked, giggling.
He turned back to face her.
Yes, get up, he said.
She stood and straightened her clothes.
Do I please you?
For an English pig, he said harshly.
Without another word, she began to undress.
What are you doing? He demanded. Captain Hunter said I should remove my clothes.
Well, I am telling you to leave them as they are, Sanson growled. From now on, you will do as I tell you.
He scanned the horizon in all directions. There was nothing except the departing longboat. It must be a trick, he thought. It must be. He turned and looked again at the girl. She licked her lips, a fetching creature. Where could he take her? Where would he be safe? He realized then that if they went up to the aft castle, he would be able to look in all directions and still enjoy this English whore.
I shall have the better of Captain Hunter, he said, and of you as well.
And he marched her up to the aft castle. A few minutes later, he had another surprise. This demure little creature was a screaming, passionate hellion who yelled and gasped and clawed, much to Sanson's happy satisfaction.
You are so big, she gasped. I did not know Frenchmen were so big.
Her fingers raked his back painfully. He was happy. He would have been less happy to know that her screams of ecstasy, for which she was amply paid, were a signal to Hunter, who was hanging just above the waterline, holding on to the rope ladder and watching the pale shapes of the sharks slip through the water all around him. Hunter had hung there since the longboat cast off. In the bow of the longboat was a scarecrow dummy, previously concealed under a tarp and erected while Hunter had been aboard the ship. It had all worked exactly as Hunter planned. Sanson dared not look down too carefully into the longboat, and as soon as it pushed off, he had been obliged to spend some moments searching the girl. By the time he got around to looking at the departing boat, it was far enough away that the dummy was convincing. At that time, had he looked directly down, he would have seen Hunter dangling there. But there was no reason to look directly down, and in any case, the girl had been instructed to distract him as soon as possible. Hunter had waited, hanging on the ropes, for many minutes before he heard her shouts of passion. They were coming from the aft castle, as he had expected. Gently, he climbed to the gun ports and slipped onto El Trinidad below decks. Hunter was not armed, and his first task was to find weapons.
He moved forward to the armory and found a short dagger and a brace of pistols, which he loaded and carefully wadded. Then he picked up a crossbow, bending his back to the metal and cocking it. Only then did he move up the gangway to the main deck. There, he paused. Looking aft, he saw Sanson standing with the girl. She was arranging her clothing. Sanson was scanning the horizon. He had spent only a few minutes in lusty action, but it had been a fatal few minutes. He watched Sanson climb down to the waist of the galleon and pace the decks. He looked over one side, then the other side, and then he stopped. He looked again. Hunter knew what he was seeing. He was seeing the wet marks on the hull that Hunter's clothing had left in an erratic pattern moving up the side of the ship to the gun ports. Sanson spun. "You bitch!" he shouted, and fired his crossbow at the girl still on the castle. In the heat of the moment, he missed her. She shrieked and ran below. Sanson started after her, then seemed to think better of it. He paused and reloaded the crossbow. Then he waited, listening. There was the sound of the girl's running feet, and then a bulkhead door slammed. Hunter guessed she had locked herself into one of the aft cabins. She would be safe enough for the moment. Sanson moved to the center of the deck and stood by the mainmast. "Hunter!" he called. "Hunter, I know you are here!" And then he laughed. For now, the advantage was his. He stood by the mast, knowing that he was out of range of any pistol from any direction, and he waited. He circled the mast cautiously, his head turning in slow, even motions. He was perfectly alert, perfectly aware. He was prepared for any tactic. Hunter was illogical. He fired both his pistols. One shot splintered the mainmast, and the other struck Sanson in the shoulder. The Frenchman grunted, but he hardly seemed to notice the injury. He spun and fired the crossbow, and the arrow streaked past Hunter, burying itself in the wood of the companionway. Hunter scrambled down the steps, hearing Sanson running after him. He had a glimpse of Sanson, both pistols out, charging forward. Hunter stepped behind the companionway ladder and held his breath. He saw Sanson running down, directly over his head, hastening down the ladder. Sanson reached the gun deck, his back to Hunter, and then Hunter said in a cold voice, "Stand there." Sanson did not stand. He spun and discharged both pistols. The balls whistled over Hunter's head as he crouched near the ground. Now he stood, holding the crossbow ready. "Things are not always as they seem," he said. Sanson grinned, raising his arms. "Hunter, my friend, I am without defense." "Go up," Hunter said, his voice flat. Sanson began to climb the steps, still holding his hands out. Hunter saw that he had a dagger at his belt. His left hand began to drop toward it. "Don't." The left hand froze. "Up." Sanson went up, with Hunter following him.
"I will still have you, my friend," Sanson said.
"You will have only a shaft up your bumhole," Hunter promised. Both men came onto the main deck. Sanson backed toward the mast.
"We must talk. We must be reasonable."
"Why?" Hunter said.
"Because I have hidden half the treasure. Look here," Sanson said, fingering a gold coin about his neck. "Here I have marked where the treasure is located. The treasure from the Cassandra. Does that not interest you?"
"It does."
"Well then,
we have reason to negotiate." "You tried to kill me," Hunter said, holding the crossbow steady.
"Would you not try the same, in my place?"
"No."
"Of course you would," Sanson said. "It is sheer impudence to deny it."
"Perhaps I would," Hunter said.
"There is no love lost between us."
"I would not have crossed you."
"You would if you could."
"No," Hunter said. "I have something like honor." At that moment, from behind him, A female voice squealed.
Oh, Charles, you got him!
Hunter turned fractionally to look at Anne Sharp, and in that moment, Sasson lunged. Hunter fired automatically. With a whoosh, the crossbow arrow was released. It shot across the deck, catching Sasson in the chest, lifting him off his feet and pinning him to the mainmast, where he swung his arms and twitched.
You have done me wrong, Sasson said, with blood dripping from his lips.
Hunter said, I was fair. Then Sasson died, his head slumping on his chest. Hunter plucked out the crossbow arrow, and the body fell to the ground. Then he pulled the gold coin with the treasure map etched in its surface from around Sasson's neck. While Anne Sharp watched, with her hand covering her mouth, Hunter dragged the body to the side of the ship and pushed it overboard. It floated on the water. The sharks circled it warily. Then one came forward, tugged at the flesh, tore away a piece. Then another, and another. The water churned and foamed blood. It lasted only a few minutes, and then the color dissipated, and the surface was still, and Hunter looked away. Epilogue. According to his own memoirs, Life Among the Privateers of the Caribbean Sea, Charles Hunter searched for Sasson's treasure during all of the year 1666, but never found it. The gold coin did not have a map scratched on its surface. Instead, there was a funny series of triangles and numbers which Hunter was never able to decipher. Sir James Almont returned to England with his niece, Lady Sarah Almont. Both perished in London's Great Fire of 1666. Mrs. Robert Hacklett remained in Port Royal until 1686, when she died of syphilis. Her son, Edgar, became a merchant of substance in the Carolina colony. In turn, his son, James Charles Hacklett Hunter, was governor of the Carolina colony in 1777, when he urged that the colony side with the northern insurgents against the English army, under the command of General Howe in Boston. Mistress Anne Sharp returned to England in 1671 as an actress. By that time, women's parts were no longer played by boys, as they had been earlier in the century. Mistress Sharp became the second most famous woman from the Indies in all Europe. The most famous, of course, being Madame de Maintenon, mistress of Louis XIV, who had been born on Guadeloupe. Anne Sharp died in 1704, after a life of what she herself described as delicious notoriety. Enders, the sea artist and barber surgeon, joined Mandeville's expedition on Campeche in 1668 and perished in a storm. The Moor, Bassa, died in 1669 in Henry Morgan's attack on Panama. He was run down by a bull, one of the many animals Spaniards released in an attempt to protect the city. Don Diego, the Jew, lived on in Port Royal until 1692, when, at an advanced age, he died in the earthquake that destroyed the wicked city forever. Lezou was captured and hanged as a pirate in Charleston, South Carolina, in 1704. She was said to have been a lover of Blackbeard. Charles Hunter, weakened by malaria during his searches for Sasson's treasure, returned to England in 1669. By that time, the raid on Montanceros had become a political embarrassment, and he was never received by Charles II, nor accorded any honor. He died of pneumonia in 1670 in a cottage in Tunbridge Wells, leaving a modest estate and a notebook which was stored at Trinity College, Cambridge. His notebook still exists, as does his grave, in the cemetery of the Church of St. Anthony in Tunbridge Wells. The stone is nearly worn smooth, yet it can still be read. Here lies Charles Hunter, Captain, 1627 to 1670, honest adventurer and seaman, beloved of his countrymen in the New World. Vinket. Thank you. This recording of Pirate Latitudes by Michael Crichton was produced and directed by Robert Kessler and performed by John Bedford Lloyd. It was recorded, edited, mixed, and mastered by Kessler Media Productions. We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. For more information about the broad range of titles from Harper Audio, Harper Children's Audio, and Cadman, please visit our website at www.harperaudio.com. Thank you for listening.